What follows are Representative Harriet Hageman's comments during the Sheridan County Republican Party's October 14th Reagan Day dinner.
All right, let's get to Harriet. I've got a quick bio to read, and then we will get her pulled up. Growing up on her family's ranch outside of Fort Laramie, Harriet learned the value of hard work, honesty, and integrity as a fourth-generation Wyomingite. Once described as one of the fiercest and most effective opponents of the Clinton administration, Harriet knows that the hardworking men and women of Wyoming deserve a leader who shares their values and will not bow down to the pressures of the liberal left as soon as the road gets a little rough. In the 118th Congress, Harriet is grateful to be chosen by her colleagues to serve on the National Resources and Judiciary Committees, along with the U.S. House Judiciary Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. Harriet chairs the Subcommittee on Indian and Insular Affairs and sits on the Subcommittee on Water, Wildlife, and Fisheries, the Subcommittee on the Administrative State Regulatory Reform and Antitrust, and the Subcommittee on the Constitution and Limited Government. This girl's gotten involved, I'll tell you that. We all know, probably, she was a practicing attorney in Wyoming for over 30 years after graduating from the University of Wyoming, and she has worked for numerous property owners against state and federal regulators' unconstitutional takings of private land for public use. She's been fighting for us long before she got to Washington. In 2019, Harriet took her fight national, joining the new Civil Liberties Alliance, a nonprofit law firm dedicated to protecting our constitutional freedoms from violation by the administrative state. Harriet has developed a reputation for standing up to federal overreach, protecting private property and water rights, exposing the failures of and working to curtail federal land and wildlife mismanagement, and challenging unconstitutional acts by both federal and state agencies. She has been recognized for her legal and policy work by numerous organizations and is nationally recognized for her expertise on federal overreach and regulation. Did I just repeat myself? I'm sorry. In addition to her active law career, Harriet has regularly been invited to speak about the dangers of regulation without representation and the risks of stockpiling more and more power in Washington, D.C. In September 2021, Harriet announced her run for Wyoming's lone congressional seat and succeeded in winning the Republican primary by 37%. And I think we're all very grateful for this role she's taken. Harriet worked tirelessly as she campaigned across the state, covering more than 54,000 miles and holding over 200 public events in just 11 months. And I think you'll agree, she's been very engaged with the people of Wyoming, and we appreciate that. We're sad she's not here in person tonight, but grateful she is fighting us for us in D.C. right now. Please help me welcome Congresswoman Harriet Hageman.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Am I on?
Yes, you are on, Harriet. We can hear you.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I'm going to jump right in. First of all, I am extremely disappointed that I am not there with you right now. I intended to be. This has been on my calendar for a long time. You all know how much I love coming to Sheridan. You do such a fantastic job up there in terms of your party and your activities and your willingness to fight for the issues that are important to Wyoming and frankly important to our country. So I know you've got another wonderful turnout. I have family there in the room this evening. I'm terribly jealous. I'm sitting here by myself in my little place in Washington, D.C. I'm going to just jump right in with where we are and why I'm sitting here right now. As you know, about 10 days ago, a small group of Republicans joined with the Democrats and filed a motion to vacate the speaker's chair. And in fact, that motion prevailed. So right now, we do not have a Speaker of the House of Representatives. We have been going through the process to resolve that. And in fact, as of last evening, I believe that we now have a speaker designate, and that is Jim Jordan from Ohio, one of the founders of the modern conservative movement, if you will. And I'm extremely excited that he will hopefully be our speaker. We should know by Tuesday. Part of the reason that I'm here is that we finished voting fairly late last evening. There was really only one flight that I could catch and still make it there. But I was told, and quite a few of us were, that they needed us to stay here in Washington, D.C., because we have such a slim majority that we have to make sure that we are available to vote. It would be an absolutely disastrous situation if we did not have enough people on the floor on Tuesday And for some reason, the Democrats were able to pick the Speaker of the House. So we're here as a bulwark against that. And then I also volunteered to make some phone calls and visit with people about supporting Jim Jordan. I endorsed him last week. I'm honored to stand with Jim. I think he will be a fantastic speaker. I have served with him on both the judiciary committees as well as the Select Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, and know that he is a great, great leader. So I'm looking forward to having this resolved so that we can move on. I also want to mention and talk about how brokenhearted I am about what happened in Israel last week. I woke up very early in the morning. I actually was at home and started looking at my phone about 5 o'clock in the morning and realized that something catastrophic had happened. At that point, we didn't know much. And as we have learned over the last week, things are just as bad as we initially thought that they could possibly be. Over 1,300 Israelis have been killed. There remain over 100 hostages. We know over 25 Americans have been killed. In addition to which, many Israelis have dual citizenship, both American and Israeli citizenship. So I think that that number will probably end up being higher. I've watched the interviews and listened as people have talked about their family members who are either missing or who have been murdered. And I can tell you that it is just absolutely heart-wrenching to see. Initially, the Biden administration had refused to pull back on the $6 billion that they were sending to Iran in exchange in a prisoner swap. As of late this week, though, I believe that there was some movement in that regard where it appeared that the Biden administration was possibly talking about freezing that money. As we have all said all along, money is fungible. They can talk until the cows come home, the idea that that money was only to be used for humanitarian purposes in Iran. And we all know that that's not true. Even if they were to do humanitarian activities on behalf of their citizens, which is questionable as well, all it did was free up $6 billion to do something else. So again, I think what we're seeing and what we've saw with the invasion of Ukraine, what we're seeing in Israel, what we're seeing in many hotspots around the world is that a weak America makes for a very dangerous world. I think that it is clear that the Biden administration has failed on many, many different fronts, but foreign policy, national security have got to be two right up at the top. I'm going to talk a little bit about that a bit more here after I go through a few other things. But what I can say is that the feeling in Washington, D.C. is that the White House is pretty rudderless right now. I think all of us recognize that Joe Biden is suffering from pretty severe dementia. We ask the same question that many of you do, which is who is running our country? Who is calling the shots? Who is making the decisions? And one of the things that we do know is that there is not one person in his cabinet who ever worked in the private sector. In other words, every single one of the people who are in positions of power right now in this White House have absolutely no real world experience of what it's like to run a business or make a payroll or suffer the consequences of the decisions that they make. And that's probably the most significant issue, is that you find that when people that the people like these who are in government are never held accountable when they fail. And we know that with the horrific withdrawal out of Afghanistan. The Americans killed a family of 10. We lost 13 of our own bravest souls, including one from right here in Wyoming. And yet no one has ever been held accountable for that debacle. And that debacle is now coming home to roost. They have found that some of the weaponry that has been used by Hamas over the last week, in fact, originated in Afghanistan and is American weaponry. Guns and other things. And so what we're seeing is that the $7 billion worth of equipment and materials that we left in Afghanistan are finding their way into terrorist hands around the world, which was a real risk and fear that we all had at the time that that whole situation unfolded. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the legislation that we have been pushing forward with. I actually think that the 118th Congress has been highly successful in terms of passing good, solid legislation. Now, it goes to the Senate. We're not getting it where it needs to go because Chuck Schumer in the Senate is sitting on it and we can't get any movement over there. But I can tell you, having been involved with this for the last 10 months as I have, the legislation that is coming out of the 118th Congress is solid conservative wins for those of us who are in that conservative camp. The Secure the Border Act, H.R. 2, that is, it is the very strongest border security bill that has ever been passed out of Congress. That bill originated in the Judiciary Committee where I sit, and it took an enormous amount of work to put together. I am extremely proud of that bill. We started working on that bill at 10 o'clock one morning and finished at 4 o'clock the next morning. We have worked hard on it. It is a piece of legislation that if it were implemented, it would change overnight what we're seeing in terms of illegal immigration and human trafficking and drug smuggling across our borders. So it's something that we continue to pound the table about, that we need to secure our borders. We need to pass H.R. 2, and we're going to keep fighting that, keep pushing forward with that. Another bill that was very important to me was the Separation of Powers Restoration Act, SOPRA. It modifies the scope of judicial review of agency actions, and it actually will bring more power back to the legislative branch where it belongs, and it will stop judges from deferring to administrative agencies in their interpretations of the law. It's a very important bill that I spoke on the floor about. I'm very proud of that. We have H.R. 1, an excellent, excellent energy bill, including my coal act, which would lift the moratorium on any new coal leases, and it would unleash the energy industry in the United States. It's focused specifically on oil and gas and coal. And again, if it were to pass, it would immediately change the situation that we're in right now with the out of control energy prices and the fact that we're empowering our enemies by having to import our resources, our energy resources from foreign and often hostile countries, such as Iran and Venezuela and Russia. We have the Trust the Science Act, which would permanently delist the gray wolves in the lower 48 states. Another act protecting access for hunters and anglers. It would prevent the Secretaries of Interior and Agriculture from banning the use of lead ammo or tackle on federal lands. H.R. 27 provides for congressional disapproval of the way that this administration has been interpreting the Clean Water Act and what is defined as a navigable water of the United States. The Limit, Save, Grow Act, it would have reduced spending to fiscal year 2022 levels, gotten our fiscal house back in order. One of the battles that we have right now in Washington, D.C., is that the Democrats and the Biden administration want to fund everything at the post-COVID levels. In other words, after they have spent massive, massive, massive amounts of federal funds and sent massive amounts of money to the states, they want to keep those budget numbers in place. And that's one of the big battles that we have and that we continue to fight over. The Small Business Taxpayer Protection Act, it would repeal the Democrat IRS army of the 87,000 new agents. The RAINS Act, this is something that I have been working on for years. And most specifically, what this would do is, again, take power away from the administrative agencies, return it to the legislative branch where it belongs. I think one of the most important aspects of this is that for any regulation that would have an impact of over $100 million, it could not go into effect unless and until Congress passed it and it was signed into law by the president. In other words, we would actually go back to regular order where it is the legislative branch, Congress, that is passing legislation. It's being presented to the president and then becoming a statute through the regular constitutional process. We've had several resolutions dealing with the COVID emergency. We have repealed the COVID emergency. That's a bill that was actually signed into law by the president. Another thing that we've had quite a bit of bipartisan support on relates to our relationship with China. We have passed a bill to, and this was a bipartisan bill with the Democrats, to prohibit President Biden from selling any more of our Strategic Petroleum Reserve oil to China. We have been selling, he has been raiding our SPR and then selling the oil to China, if you can believe that. I think that that probably is one of the tells about how this president has been compromised by his son's relationship with China and the fact that he was earning substantial amounts of money from the Chinese Communist Party. And I will get to that a little bit in a little bit more detail when I talk about our impeachment inquiry. We also are pushing back hard against the ATF and their continued effort to make felons out of all of us by banning things such as pistol braces and bump stocks. We're pushing back hard against those things. We passed a bill to block those regulations from being able to go into effect. And then also, we have started the impeachment inquiry, and I want to talk about that for a little bit. We are not walking down the road of impeachment. That isn't at this point, because we have to gather the evidence and present this to the American public. There are three committees that have jurisdiction over this particular type of impeachment inquiry because of the nature of the allegations against Joe Biden and what he has done, both as vice president, as a regular citizen while he was out of office, and then again while he has been president of the United States. And I think it's very important for everybody to understand that we're looking at all three of those timelines. Most specifically, the Ways and Means Committee is involved because of all the IRS activity. The fact that Hunter Biden was not paying taxes on the money that was coming into this country from foreign malign actors, the $20 million that we know of that has come from the Chinese Communist Party, from Ukraine, Uzbekistan, and Romania, and a variety of other countries. So Ways and Means is involved. As you know, and you've been watching, Jamie Comer, who is the head of the Oversight Committee, they've been overseeing the impeachment proceedings, impeachment inquiry proceedings up to this point. They are the ones that have really been able to do a deep dive into the bank records, into the accounting records, and bringing in the whistleblowers from the IRS, bringing in other whistleblowers who can describe and explain that Hunter Biden has definitely received a preferential treatment from the current FBI and Department of Justice as they have attempted to cover up his activities, both in relation to his foreign activities and never having registered as a foreign agent, as well as, again, the amount of money that he was paid by foreign actors while his father was vice president and running for office. While he was running for president of the United States, and the extent to which some of that money has also found its way into Joe Biden's hands. And then judiciary, the committee that I am on, I believe that we will probably be doing somewhat batting cleanup on this. We also have been meeting with with whistleblowers. We have been meeting and going through documents, reviewing files to look at the nature of the relationship between Hunter and Joe Biden. You know, there are many people who say, this is about Hunter Biden. That's not Joe Biden. What his son did has nothing to do with him. But the reality is that's just simply a deflection from the truth. Hunter Biden had no skill set. Hunter Biden was an admitted crackhead, heavy crack user from 2003 to 2019, the very period of time that all of these activities were going on. As the person from Burisma commented, one of the folks who ran Burisma in the Ukraine said, Hunter Biden is dumber than my dog, but we have to have him because of his connections. Well, his connections were his dad. Hunter Biden had no assets to sell. He had no skill set to sell. The only asset that he had to sell was his father. Access when Joe Biden was vice president, when Joe Biden was running for president. And then now, again, I think when you see what has happened with the Chinese Communist Party, for example, the spy balloon being allowed to traverse the entire trajectory of our country, the fact that we've got the amount of money that is going to the Ukraine and no accounting. We can't get an accounting. One of the things that we keep doing is demanding that before we will continue to send any money to Ukraine whatsoever, we have to have an accounting of the money that has already been spent. We must know where it has gone. We must have the ability to track it. We must know by what metric we're going to be able to determine whether we're winning this war or not. We have to have an exit strategy. We have to have a plan of action. None of this is happening. We're just taking huge like t-shirt shooters and just spraying Ukraine with massive amounts of money with no accountability whatsoever. And I know that my fellow Republicans in the House are really fed up with that. And we have made it clear that we're going to push back awfully hard against any effort to continue to provide funding when we have received no information whatsoever about all of the items that I just identified. It's also very important to understand, and I think it was clear when we were questioning, if any of you watched the videos in the Judiciary Committee, when we were questioning Christopher Wray and Merrick Garland, Christopher Wray from the FBI and Merrick Garland from the Department of Justice. These gentlemen, along with their offices, have clearly been covering up what has gone on with the Biden administration. They clearly covered up the Hunter Biden laptop. They have clearly attempted to deflect any attention whatsoever from Joe Biden being the big guy. About 2 weeks ago, there was an email that has now been released. It was internal to the Department of Justice, and they admitted, this was a couple of years ago, but in the email, they talk about the fact that in the writings, in the materials related to Hunter Biden, Joe Biden was the, quote, big guy. So the Department of Justice, the FBI, have known for quite some time. And if you remember, that's the way that Bobulinski in 2020, in 2019 and 20, was describing Joe Biden's role in Hunter Biden's nefarious activities for these malign actors around the world, that 10% for the big guy. I'm going to get the big guy on the phone. We got to talk to the big guy. Everybody's tried to protect Joe Biden, acting as though he didn't have anything to do with Hunter's activities. And even the DOJ's internal documents demonstrates that they were well aware that he did, but they have been working overtime to cover it up. So we are also, I think, going to have to continue to investigate what has been going on with the Department of Justice, with the FBI, which brings me to another issue. And I don't know if any of you watched the hearing with John Durham, but he testified a couple of months ago that, I guess it was July is when he testified, that they knew, they being Obama and Joe Biden and the head of the Department of Justice and the head of the FBI, everybody knew in August of 2016, before the 2016 election, that the claim of Russia collusion and the Steele dossier were a political dirty trick funded by Hillary Clinton. Now, keep in mind what happened after that. They destroyed General Michael Flynn. They started the Mueller investigation. They crippled President Trump's first 2 years in office with that Mueller investigation. There was a constant drumbeat of Russia, 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 and collusion and election theft and all of those things. And the people involved, including Christopher Wray and these folks, knew before the 2016 election that the Steele dossier was a political dirty trick and that there was no verifiable information in there. So I think that gives you an idea of the level of corruption that we're dealing with back here in Washington, D.C. The Judiciary Committee and the Oversight Committee, especially, as well as Ways and Means, through our whistleblowers, through our public questioning of these officials, we're working very, very hard to expose this, to make sure that the American public understands what has happened, what is happening. And then we're going to, I think, do something about it. Do I believe that Joe Biden has committed an impeachable offense? Yes, I do. But I'm not the only person that needs to be convinced. We're going to have to convince the American public. In reality, that's our jury. We've got to present the evidence. But I think that it's very clear that he and his son were involved with all kinds of shakedowns with a variety of countries around the world. Kazakhstan, Romania, CCP, the CCP, Ukraine, as I've indicated, while Joe Biden was vice president. I think that our current foreign policy is being impacted in a dramatic way because of this. I just learned today by reading a variety of articles that Joe Biden has, in fact, been sending money to the Palestinians, the Hamas, and now we have this horrific attack on Israel. So the fact is that those are the kinds of things that we need to get to, and we need to get to the bottom of it, and we need to expose. I just don't know that our country can heal with some of the divisions that we have right now until we actually expose this level of corruption. because I think that we also need to show that just stockpiling more and more power in Washington, D.C. only furthers and fosters this kind of corruption and these kinds of nefarious acts, to use that terminology again. So it is one of the reasons why I was terribly disappointed about what happened with our speaker. I know that Kevin McCarthy is probably considered more liberal than I am, but Kevin McCarthy did a good job as our speaker. He kept us together. There was no limit on the kinds of bills that we could introduce, the amendments. We've had an entirely open amendment process for the first time in 20 years, or over 20 years. Last week, when we were doing one of our appropriations bills, we were doing amendments until 4 o'clock in the morning. I was on the floor of the House at 2:30 in the morning offering my amendments and having them passed. And I'm very proud of some of the bills and amendments that I've been able to get through on the priorities that I have. Right now, we're kind of in a holding pattern until we can get that speaker back in place. Again, I'm very hopeful that will happen on Tuesday so that we can then proceed with business. As far as budgeting and financing, I think the press has done a very poor job of actually reporting what the Republican-controlled House has done. We have passed 4 appropriations bills, the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, Homeland Security. These bills together account for about 70% of federal discretionary spending. So if the Senate were to take them up, which they have not been willing to do yet, the Senate won't take up our bills, but if they were to take them up, we could be moving forward with funding 70% of the government right now without any concern about an omnibus or anything else. And that's what we've been trying to push forward with. So one of the things that I'm very proud of with these bills is that we have gone through, not me because I'm not on these particular committees, but especially our Armed Services Committee, our VA committee, our committees, the people who deal with a lot of our military and national security issues, they have gone through and they have stripped every bit of woke nonsense and funding for all of the woke nonsense out of all of these bills. Stop the CRT training, stop the ESG nonsense, stop the radicalization of our soldiers, and focus on protecting the home country is what we really need to do. So these are good bills, they're solid bills. We still have 8 appropriations bills to go. If we can get a speaker in place by Tuesday, I'm very hopeful that we can have at least one more appropriations bill out by next Friday. We're kind of racing against the clock right now. We do not want the Senate to send over an omnibus, which is what they're trying to wait to do, which is why they won't take up our appropriations bills. But I want all of you to know that the House is working extremely hard to do our job, to do the appropriations, to return to regular order, to do the budgeting process the way that we are supposed to. I've had an opportunity over the last week to talk about some extremely important policy issues that I want to pursue, including dramatically changing the Administrative Procedure Act to take more power away from these administrative agencies. And I've met with the head of the Budget Committee, the head of the Subcommittee on Regulatory Reform, and some of the other folks in the 118th Congress who are experts in this area. I'm hoping that I can be appointed to head this particular plan of action up, and I plan to speak with Jim Jordan next week, if he's our speaker, about that very issue. You know, in closing, again, I want to tell you how proud I am to represent the state of Wyoming, how proud I am to be from Wyoming, how proud I am of my family in Wyoming. It is interesting to me, as I've gotten to know people back here in Washington, D.C., how much people love my state. I mean, they just love Wyoming. They love our state. They love what we stand for. They love our beauty. They love the fact that we're the least populated state in the nation. Almost every day, somebody says something to me of, if I could only live in Wyoming. And it makes me very proud. I believe them when they say it. I think that we're kind of the last best place in the United States. We need to protect it. We need to make sure that we are protecting our resources. And by that, I mean using them, and using our energy resources and protecting our resource producers, protecting our farmers and ranchers who do such a beautiful job of protecting our lands and our waters. But I guess it's been an incredible honor to be back here and to be Wyoming's lone congressional representative. Again, I'm so sorry that I'm not there with you. Another time, I'll be back there. I'll be back up there before you know it. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be able to address you this way. It's not ideal, but at least I get an opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you, Harriet.
Are we done for the evening?
All right, we have a couple things. Well, first of all, we're going to take three questions. So I'm going to let Mike Trampy, Harriet, we have something to give you tonight. I'll let him speak, and then I'll take three questions, and you're going to have to speak into this mic for her to be able to hear you. So raise your hand, and I will come to you. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Harriet, on behalf of the Sheridan County Republican Party and the Trampy family, for all your hard work there in Washington, D.C., on our behalf, we'd like to present to you this pair of Western Cowboy spurs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Harriet, I wish you could see them. They are awesome. I'm sure they'll get those shipped to you right away. So, okay.
Have someone take a photograph of them. Trinity or Hugh and Lee can take a photograph for me.
All right, Trinity, find Mike. Mike, Trinity. They're the opposite ends of the room here. All right, so first question. Do we have a question from anyone? We're going to do three, and that's it. Any questions for Harriet? I see one back here. Let's see if I can make it back. All right, go ahead.
Thank you very much for talking to us tonight. I've read in an article that there is a congressman, I think he's from Missouri, but I can't be sure, who has written a bill that would allow states to deport illegal aliens.
Yes.
Can you tell me what's going on with that and what you think of it?
Well, I haven't heard of that one. I'm trying to think who the Missouri representatives are. There's Jason Smith, there's Mark Alford, there's Miller. I'm trying to think who else it could be from there. Eric Burleson. I have not heard of that bill, but we've got to do something. It is one of the biggest crises that we have ever seen, and it is all self-inflicted. And with what has happened in Israel, the fact that this administration has not slammed shut every single gate they could possibly find and working overtime to build the fence is absolutely mind-blowing to me. But it also demonstrates that there is an agenda so far above and beyond protecting the United States of America that we've got to get to the bottom of what it is. I visited the border. I was down there. The Judiciary Committee had a field hearing in February, and I was out there at the fence at about 1:30 in the morning, and I was standing with one of the law enforcement officers. I don't know if he was, I think he was a local sheriff's deputy, because we were standing there at 1:30 in the morning, and he pointed across to an area where the fence had not been completed. It was about a 50-foot gap, and he said, "This is a hot spot." And it's like, "Yeah, well, I could have figured that one out." And he said, "We have found over 200 bodies just on the other side of this area." And I thought, that's so weird. Why would you be finding all these bodies? They just walk through and then you process them and then you release them into the United States. I mean, there's no reason they're not crawling across the desert over there and run out of water. And he said, "You can't cross the border illegally unless you go through the cartels." And they have actual bracelets, which this is a bracelet you all gave me last year, but they have bracelets. They have color-coded bracelets, depending upon your nationality, where you come from, and how much you have to pay to get across. And you can't come across that border without paying the cartels. And if you try to, they will kill you. And they leave your body there as a warning to everybody else. They have made, by February, just in the first year and a half, they had made over $15 billion in human trafficking. Drug smuggling isn't even their biggest industry anymore. Human trafficking is. I say that Joe Biden and Alejandro Mayorkas are the two largest human traffickers and drug smugglers in U.S. history, and they are. We had an opportunity to question Mayorkas. He absolutely sat there hour after hour after hour and lied through his teeth about them having operational control of the border. I will sign on to anything that I think is going to be effective at actually resolving this issue, because this is going to be a catastrophe. A couple of weeks ago, I had to go to Manhattan for meetings. I took the train up, and I got off the train in New York, in downtown New York, walked out of the train station, and there were about 150 men standing there from Africa. And you could tell where they were from. They don't speak our language. They don't have anything. They're living on the street. They're standing there with nothing to do. They don't have jobs. They most likely are never going to get married. They're never going to have families. They're in a strange culture. People, they just were brought there and they're dumped out. And the you can't even get a taxi around the train station anymore because the entire area has been taken over and is one huge homeless camp. It is frightening what is happening on our border and what this administration is doing. And we have got to do everything we possibly can to get this man out of office next year. In the meantime, he's going to be terribly destructive, but my gosh, we've got to get him out of office.
Hi, Harriet. It's Tom Kelly. And I have to say, I'm so heartbroken you're not here. You're the only member of Congress who's ever hugged me. If things fall through with Jim Jordan, would you consider running for speaker?
Tom, that's very sweet of you, and that's very kind of you. I'm not ready for that position. And keep in mind that it is in many ways an administrative position, and there is a lot of knowledge that goes into understanding. You run the entire Capitol Police Force. You're responsible for the security of the entire campus. That's why Nancy, this whole thing about January 6th was as much of a cover-up of what Nancy, Nancy Pelosi, her failures on January 6th is as much as anything else. I do appreciate that, but I think that there are people who are better qualified than I am, Tom.
Hi, Harriet. It's Joey Carreni. How you doing?
Hi.
Good to have you here. Any way we can get you, we'll take you. We know you're fighting hard for us out there, so thanks for zooming in, and we know you'll be back in Wyoming real soon. Speaking of, when you come back, there's an issue we're dealing with here, which I know you've taken testimony or tried to pry testimony out of some Department of the Interior and BLM representatives over the last few weeks. And what we saw at a couple of these BLM meetings was that they have no answer over things like adverse possession and access to our private property, which contain our primary residences within the checkerboard when they close down these lands. So what is it that Congress can do, or that you can do in Congress, to help combat this really bad plan that's going to deny us, you know, our Fourth Amendment right to not only own but access and use our property before, you know, Wyoming property owners do what Wyoming property owners are going to do?
So right now, what we're doing is we are working through the appropriations process to try to stop them from being able to implement any of the alternatives that they have described, most specifically B and C, but there are also concerns with D as well. So my office, we're running an amendment to be able to block them from being able to use any funds to implement this and to force them to keep the current RMP in place. So that's one of the things that I'm doing legislatively back here, where we are continuing to talk about what we can do. This is one of the problems with turning over as much power as we have to these administrative agencies, is we have really disenfranchised the legislative branch from being able to oversee them and use our authority to say, no, you can't do that. One of the things that we do have is the power of the purse. And I was working with one of my legislative assistants just yesterday, working on the language for the bill. We have been in touch with the governor's office. We have been in touch with our livestock organizations. We have been in touch with the counties. We have been in touch with all kinds of folks in southwestern Wyoming, asking them what it is that they want us to do so that we can get it done. So we've had a lot of really good conversations with like Kent Connolly and those kinds of folks saying, all right, these are what our options are. What do you want? So we've had those kinds of conference calls and meetings. So it's actually been a fantastic give and take and dialogue between my office and the state and local officials to make sure that I can do everything that I so that I'm doing everything I can back here. So that's part of what we're doing. You got to make sure that the governor is willing to sue over this. You guys got to push the governor to sue. And I know that he's indicated that he will. I'm very proud of him for that. I'm very pleased. He's been in touch about what they can do, you know, how to approach this. One of the things to keep in mind is that the BLM was created for a purpose. It was authorized to do X, Y, and Z. It is not the national park. The BLM is not, those are not national park lands. Those are supposed to be multiple use. And so there are a variety of things that I think that you can push back legally. One of the things I would encourage you to talk to the governor about, and if you have contacts in other states, every Western state in the nation should join this lawsuit, because this is just the first one. Tracy Stone Manning is the head of the BLM. She's an eco-terrorist. She was involved in organizations that used to spike trees in the 80s and 90s to try to kill loggers if they went in and logged in certain national forests. She's a terrible human being. This is her goal. She wants to shut down access to all of it. But this is the test case to see if they can do it. So again, let's make sure that the governor and the attorney general move forward and challenge this legally. And then they need to make sure that they get every Western state with lots of with federal lands. Every state in the Western United States ought to be joining this, and they need to get an injunction to block them from being able to implement it. From my side, I'm trying to defund their ability to implement it.
Excellent, Harriet. Thank you. And excellent questions, too, you guys. Great. And yeah. Harriet, we love hearing from you. We're going to give you one more round of applause. Please, let's thank Harriet for being here tonight.
Thank you.